Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It is Friday. Time for the Week in Review. First up, the end of the legislative session on Beacon Hill.
All those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed, no. The ayes have it, and the Senate stands adjourned.
All right. Well, some bills made it through before the session closed early on Wednesday, but plenty of others did not, such as a bill that would have increased K-12 education funding across the state. Senator Sonia Chang-Diaz says somehow that one died in conference committee, even with bipartisan support.
This bill should not have been difficult to negotiate. The legislature has been working on this issue for 8 years. The original bill was backed by two-thirds of the House, by 100% of the Senate, both Democrat and Republican. But in the end, the House leadership rejected all our offers, moved the goalposts, and then killed the bill completely.
There were other bills that didn't make it across the finish line, too. Healthcare financing reforms, sex education guidelines, and a proposed ban on gay conversion therapy, just to name a few. But the legislature did manage to pass the opioid bill, though they removed the forced treatment component Governor Baker had supported. State Representative Denise Garlick supported a provision that did make it into the final bill.
The introduction of medication-assisted treatment in the emergency room gives us an opportunity to decrease the suffering that individual is actually having and give them a pathway to make a decision for voluntary care.
So some wins, some losses, but also a lot of questions, such as why does business as usual on Beacon Hill always seem to involve the unusual business of last-second bargaining behind closed doors? Why does the fate of what could be landmark legislation often seem to come down to utterly opaque negotiations? Well, joining us now to discuss is Reverend Mariama White-Hammond. She's minister at the Bethel AME Church in Jamaica Plain. Reverend White-Hammond, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is John Carroll. He's a professor of communication at Boston University, a senior analyst for WBU. You are as well. Good to see you, John.
Good to be here.
All right, so John, give me your first take. Do you love how business is done on Beacon Hill?
No, nobody does.
except the legislature, perhaps.
Maybe. And a lot of times these bills are sort of like Christmas morning, you know, something for everybody. But this was more like what my parents used to call a lean Christmas. This one was one where there were major initiatives that didn't make it through. Education, healthcare, housing. Mm-hmm. Those three were ones that fell by the wayside. And I think one of the problems is leaving these toward the end.
Yeah.
Leaves you in a position where it's a lot easier to either water them down or kill them than for them to get passed through a complicated process. Mm-hmm. So I think this is one of those situations where if they had spent their time more wisely, they might have achieved more by the end of the session.
But on the other hand, I mean, to be fair, just the other day we were talking about this exact issue on the show, and I was pretty critical of Beacon Hill. But earlier this year, they did pass criminal justice reform. So, you know, when big...
Which they've been working on for 10 years.
Okay.
So let's not act like
ahead.
In 2 years they made it happen. I mean, this issue had been bandied about for quite a long time. So I do, of course, want to celebrate that. That was important. And it shouldn't take, you know, 10 years of discussion for us to finally pass something every time.
Yeah. And what about the idea that when it comes down, as John was saying, to these last minute negotiations, when everything's left to the last couple days or weeks, it also goes, for example, when it's in conference committee, behind closed doors, and we will literally never know because of the lack of public records laws around the legislature, what happened?
I've had incidences where the actual legislators that sponsor bills didn't know what was in them as they were going to vote on them, where their staff was in the back room trying to read through them very quickly because they came out the night before and then, you know, everybody has to vote on them. And that's, I think, one of the larger problems is when you do it this way, do our legislators actually know what they're voting on? When they're coming out of committee on Monday night and then you're voting on them on Tuesday morning, does anybody really have time to read them all the way through and know what's in them? So I think this is just not a good way to do business. And I think one of the huge dysfunctions is We have two houses that don't work well together. You can get one thing that comes out of the House and another thing that comes out of the Senate, and they will be like night and day, and it's very hard for them to negotiate.
Well, so, I mean, the education financing bill was a perfect example of that. Like, theoretically, there was bipartisan support for updating the foundation budget formula, but the two bills were quite different from the House and Senate.
Right, and people look at Massachusetts and they think, oh, liberal state, it's all Democrats who run the House and Senate. So they should be able to get things done. But the Senate is much more liberal than the House. And when it comes down to final negotiations, a lot of times that makes the difference. I don't want to be the skunk at the garden party here, but let me point out that last year the legislators gave themselves a pretty hefty pay raise with the promise that they would be more productive because they were making more money. I mean, I promise that to my boss all the time. You know?
My boss hasn't worked out yet.
But so I'll just say I'm not sure that the taxpayers of Massachusetts are getting their money's worth here.
Okay.
Well, that is a quite good point. I mean, I entered the wrong profession for making a lot of money. But I do think the other piece of this is that a lot of these folks are unchallenged.
Yeah.
You have maybe 20 competitive races in the entire legislature. You know, if you're not concerned that you might lose your job and you get paid to do less, what's your incentive to do your best? And I'm not saying that these are bad folks. I'm just saying all of us work better when we know we'll be held accountable, when we know the structures are in place. And unfortunately, when you have people who year over year don't have anybody even challenge them, complacency might be what we should come to expect in that kind of situation.
Reverend White Hammond calling for primaries across Massachusetts.
I'm just saying.
I'm here for that.
or term limits. Or term limits, although you're probably not going to get them to pass term limits on themselves. But, however, one thing that might help is campaign finance reform. If there were publicly funded campaigns in this state, the way there should have been under the Clean Elections Act that was passed overwhelmingly by the voters, then you might have more competition. But the way it's set up now, it's pretty much a walled garden.
Okay. Well, you know, we didn't actually talk in detail about the stuff that did pass, such as the opioid legislation. But I will. Congratulations, Beacon Hill. You passed that bill. It's an important one.
Right.
But in order for us to cover all the other of week's news, I'm just going to move on. Now that we've had our moment with the legislative process in Massachusetts, I want to talk about a development in the world of, well, I guess the brave new world of transportation. And that's Bird, you know, the company with the shareable dockless scooters. Look at your face. Are you not a fan of them?
No, I just used a Blue Bike to get here today. It was a nightmare on Comm Ave. And if it weren't for Blue Bike, I'd probably still be walking.
You'd be on the phone with us.
I think I am challenged that the conversation feels like it's gotten poisoned already. And maybe people didn't make the best decisions in how we've started this conversation.
You mean with Bird just launching without talking to the cities in which it's going to launch?
Yeah, I think that's generally a good idea to just drop off things in people's homes. Even if they might like those things, it's maybe not the best way to get started.
So these shareable dockless scooters, they're in Somerville, Cambridge. Those officials in both cities are saying they were never notified. Now, this is a strategy, of course, that we've seen before. Here's some tape. This is Danny Hong. He's a tech sector specialist with the consulting firm with Bain.
Just take the Uber model. Once people have it, people enjoy it, it's very hard to then pull it back.
What do you think?
Well, their official slogan is it's easier to ask forgiveness than permission. So, Uber started out this way to a large degree as well. You go in, you create facts on the ground, and then you see if they can kick you out. And if you have enough people, and they have right now, Bird has a form email that you can send to Cambridge City officials saying, I love these guys, so please, make them legitimate and let them operate. I think that that's a flawed business strategy in many places. The Boston Business Journal had an editorial and said to the Bird officials, grow up. You can't just parachute into a city. Go do it the right way.
Grow up? I mean, a lot of the people working in these companies maybe don't have that much experience with public sector regulation.
The guy who runs it, the CEO,
he
was one
Uber,
of the founders of Uber.
Well, so he's doing what he knows.
That's in the DNA, I guess, yeah.
Mariama, what do you think?
Well, you know, I think so here's what the first thing I think as somebody who cares a lot about our planet, I'm open to anything that's going to help with our transportation challenges, help people to get around. The small challenge that I have around these is that I'm not actually sure. So for me, one of the first questions is it going to cut down on the amount of fossil fuel emissions? Mm. Not exactly sure that people are going to sort of do the scooter in replacement of a car.
Oh, you think they'll just ride them for
fun?
So
actually the evidence is now, and okay. I'm going to be honest, yeah. I take Lyft. I'm not going to, you know, deny that. It's actually not cutting down on fossil fuel emissions.
And it's making our congestion worse.
I work with a lot of young people who now, instead of taking the T, are taking, you know, Ubers and Lyfts all over the place. Yeah. Sometimes I have to remind them that they have a little bit of a budget and that, you know, $2.25 is better than $5 or $6.
But these scooters
every time.
Are electric, right? They're like rechargeable electric scooters. Right. So,
but my question is, are they just going to prevent people from, are they going to replace walking? Uh-huh. And now I'm going to be on the sidewalk with someone who doesn't really know how to use a scooter that's running me over? Or are they functionally really going to replace cars? If they're going to replace congestion in cars, I'm for them. Yeah. If I'm just going to have to now watch out for people accidentally hitting me with a scooter, then I'm concerned. And I'm not sure if that business model has been worked out.
Go ahead, John.
By law, they're supposed to be in the street.
They're motorized, yeah.
Right. But there are all kinds of safety issues here. You know, one of the things that the Mass Department of Transportation is looking into is that they don't comply with the regulations in Massachusetts that you need brake lights and blinkers. You know, so that's one thing. They supposedly get people to agree to wear a helmet when they unlock the scooter, but there's no enforcement of that. And so there's a lot of people going around without helmets.
Yeah.
So there's all kinds of safety issues. And, you know, they're setting up what they call a global safety advisory board. Once they do something like that, you know the smoke and mirrors are coming in a major way.
Now, you see, I have to say, I'm completely, theoretically, I'm absolutely for what you were saying, Miriam, what these companies are doing, you know, alternative forms of transportation, and hopefully the greener the better.
Yeah.
And because, like, we have to modernize our transportation system, and maybe private sector companies that are up to the gills with VC funding, you know, pushing cities along and saying, like, we're here, it's time for you to update your regulations. Maybe that's just the way we have to do it in this day and age. But I mean, there's so many complications, and Mariama, you really hit on one of them. You both hit on some of them. There's so many. One is, isn't it better to work with cities to begin with, right?
Yep.
And two, you just slipped it in there. I don't love the idea of being on the sidewalk and having to dodge these scooters.
Yeah, because I think the reality is that the people who want an alternate form of transportation are highly likely to take bikes, which are safer and get you further. And so I'm worried that people go, oh my gosh, I don't want to walk three blocks. Let me get this motorized scooter that I just am not exactly sure how to ride.
Yeah.
And if they don't have the brake lights and you're not wearing the helmet, you know, accidents will happen.
We've got cars, we've got bikes, we've got scooters, I'm seeing more and more motorized skateboards.
Right. Right.
You know,
and don't forget the kids with the wheels in their shoes that blink, which actually at least they have brake lights.
Right. Right. Well, they have a new word for it now. It's micro mobility.
Yeah.
And this thing is going to happen in San Francisco. There are 12 companies asking for scooter operations permits. 12 of them. So, you know, this I think is going to happen. What the cities and towns need to do is to be more proactive and say, if you want to come in here, Boston is a big market, and, you know, they don't want Bird in because they have an exclusive deal with the Blue Bikes. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they're going after other sort of dockless bikes. They're worried about Bird. I mean, there's all kinds of competing interests here that the cities and towns need to be proactive about sorting out. I mean, they sit back and these things happen to them, and then, you know, they're clutching their pearls saying, you know, what are we going to do about this? And
well, they're going to issue ultimatums and round them up.
Yeah.
Well, and I think the big thing for me is all of this has to lead to less congestion and less pollution. And it's not clear yet that that's actually happening. I mean, if everybody's just riding around in all these different forms, it could be chaos. So I do think, you know, that's my concern as someone who's afraid of getting doored myself, who's constantly hoping I don't hit anybody's bike, who's, you know, like, you know, it's sometimes it feels like the Wild West out there, and I'm just not sure that we need another thing to enter the picture.
All right, so let's move on, because definitely when it comes to all issues of transportation, we could talk for hours about that here. But I want to talk about the latest poll from WBUR about the race between Congressman Michael Capuano and Boston City Councilor Ayanna Pressley. This is for the congressional seat in the 7th District of Massachusetts. And according to the Mass Inc. polling group and its president, Steve Cazella, whom we spoke with earlier this week, he conducted the poll for WBUR. Here's the big headline.
The big headline is one of stability. We pulled this one back in February, and the race is basically unchanged. We had a 12-point margin last time. We have a 13-point margin this time.
A 13-point margin in favor of Congressman Capuano, I should say. But when you break down the numbers, things actually get pretty interesting.
Support is very different across demographic groups. When you're looking at young people are much more likely to support Ayanna Pressley compared to older people who are much more likely to support Michael Capuano. So it really depends who actually shows up on primary day, which tends to be older people, which would favor Capuano. But if there's one of these turnout surges that we've seen elsewhere in the country, it could at least change the numbers, even if whether or not it's enough for her to win.
So, Mariama, turnout, turnout, turnout.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is really, I mean, I think a lot of this has to do with what young people are thinking and feeling and learning from the last election. I am one of those folks that votes all the time. I've missed two elections in my entire life, and that's even with special elections included. But that's not true for the most people under the age of 40.
Right.
So the I think one of the big questions, but here's what I will say, and I work with a lot of young people. After the election of Trump, many of my young people who used to say elections didn't matter started saying, well, they don't do everything, but they might kind of matter. And so the question is, for that demographic, after the Parkland shooting, et cetera,
yeah,
are they going to show up? And that's not just in this race. I mean, quite frankly, this is a question nationally. A lot of women, a lot of people of color have entered this this particular race. You've got a lot of people running for all sorts of offices, not just national offices, local folks. And the question is, have young people been jarred enough that they're willing to change their behavior and start showing up?
And in addition to that, I don't think this is no small thing. In Massachusetts, they've parked primary day right after Labor Day, too. So,
yeah,
you know, I don't love that. But
not helpful.
No.
No, it's not helpful. But, I mean, the alternative was it was two Jewish holidays or the following two Tuesdays. So,
right,
you know, there were Bill Galvin was kind of in a bind there.
Yeah.
I'm interested in what's going to happen from here. When Ayanna Pressley looks at this poll and says, how do I make up 13 points? You know, one of the problems in this race is that there aren't that many policy differences between the two. So what do you do? Do you ratchet up the rhetoric? I think she would be reluctant to do that because I don't think that's the tone she wants to set. And so I think the challenge is completely around turnout. And the challenge is to get people to vote who don't normally vote in primaries.
Yeah.
And that's it's difficult. It's not impossible. You know, what this parallel between Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez
in New York,
York, you know, it doesn't really work here because one of the reasons she won was that Joe Crowley, the incumbent,
just took it for granted.
He didn't even I don't even think he had a headquarters for the most part. So he may have. I don't know.
There was also lots of daylight between them policy wise.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
So those two differences, I think that dynamic doesn't translate here. She needs to do something different and something a little more radical.
So I think the other piece of it is, and I don't remember what the exact numbers is, that there's a significant number of people who are undecided. And the reality is, and I've seen this on many different campaigns, it's the summer and people are just not paying attention. So the other question is, you know, there will be a moment where kids start going back to school and vacations start being over that suddenly people go, oh yeah, the primary's coming up. Maybe I should figure out where I stand. And it's a very short period of time.
Yep.
And it will matter who are those undecideds, what are their demographics, and which candidate do they flow towards. So
yeah.
I think in terms of making up that 13%, the question is, do those undecideds tend to break for her? Because if they do, that changes the question.
Well,
and a lot of them are just going to wake up and go, oh, the primary is over. and that's going to be one of the problems.
Well, here, I'm hoping that everyone listening today, right now, tells all their friends who may all across the state, wherever you live, that you know that yes, the primary is coming, you got to vote, and especially if you live in the 7th, we are having a debate between between Congressman Capuano
and who happens to be hosting that debate,
and Councilor Ayanna Pressley. It's going to be Tuesday. This coming Tuesday at 3 o'clock. Right here on Radio Boston. We're doing it along with the Boston Globe. Adrian Walker is going to be my co-moderator. UMass Boston's McCormick Graduate School of Policy, also a major part of this this debate. And it's going to be, again, it's going to be at UMass, but airing here on Radio Boston at 3 o'clock on Tuesday, plus on Facebook. It'll be online. Yep. It's gonna be great. So,
Joe, I mean, I think one quick point, and I think the question is, I think a lot of people have said, well, they're aligned around policy. And I think, so this question is both what you're going to get done and how you're going to get things done. And I think that's where what matters to young people. I know it's something that also matters to me. I'm not quite as young anymore. But when I look at what's happening at, you know, the State House, when I look at what's happening at the Capitol, I want to know that some different approach is going to be had because I'm tired of people making decisions behind closed doors. And I'm tired with, you know, opaque politics that we can't fully understand. So I think they need to talk about where they stand, but I also think they need to talk about how we're going to break the kind of gridlock and sort of dysfunctionalness that's happening in a lot of government.
I will be sure to ask them about that. How's that?
Sounds good.
We've got just enough time for our hubbubs on this sweltering Friday afternoon. So, John, go.
My hubbub has to do with Clark Booth, the legendary Boston reporter who died last week. The obituaries I read were very, you know, positive, full of praise for him. He was 25 years at CVB. By the way, he wrote his own obituary, and you can read it at the WCVB website. But one thing that none of the obituaries talked about was this landmark piece that he wrote in 1976 for The Real Paper. He went down to Super Bowl X in New Orleans and talked to the Steelers and the Cowboys about the physical and psychological toll that football was taking on them.
Interesting.
And he said he was in the locker room and he said people would start to talk, other people would come up. He said they were amazingly open. So in 2012, Joe Nocera, who was a New York Times columnist at the time, tracked down Clark Booth in Florida to talk to him about it. And he said, Clark said, I was amazed. And here's what Nocera wrote. Other reporters who overheard Booth's interviews were also amazed. But Booth never had to worry about being scooped. Sports writers back then just didn't write about subjects like whether concussions led to dementia.
Yeah.
They were fascinated, said Booth, but they had no use for the material. So I think it's emblematic of Clark Booth as a reporter that he did have use for it.
Wow.
So RIP Clark Booth.
Absolutely. Great hubbub, John. Thank you for that. Mariama, yours?
Yeah, so I just found out that Egypt is about to build one of the largest solar arrays in the world, 1.8 gigawatts. They're going to get like 42% of their energy from solar. And I figured, you know what? They have a lot of sun over there. So I think it should turn up well. So that's my hubbub for this week. And then I have to say, Magna, I'm more than willing to stay for the next segment.
You're sitting right by the liquor.
I focus on spirit. Spirit is part of the job that I do. And so I'd be more than willing to also share in the spirits that are in front of me for this next segment on bartending and cocktails.
If you want to hang around, so we're going to do something else before we do the cocktail segments, but if you want to hang around, it's just another 12 or so minutes. You are more than welcome.
Will the bar be open?
I guess, why don't you all stay? Everybody knows your name here. Okay, well, that's just going to be my hubbub. Later in the show, we're going to be mixing great summer cocktails. So Reverend Mariama White-Hammond, minister at the Bethel AME Church in Jamaica Plain, thank you, and will you stay?
Hey, I think I might.
Okay, great. And John Carroll, Boston University professor of communication and WBUR analyst, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.